This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
To be on the mailing list for our two organizations. So if this is interests you, please do sign up. Without further ado, please welcome Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Hart.
All right, well, thank you very much. I'm going to stand off here to the side. If I'm blocking anyone's view, just let me know. As Catherine mentioned, my name is John Goodwin, the Humane Society of the United States. And animal fighting is certainly an issue that during the last year, year and a half, has received a lot of publicity. There's been a real strong spotlight on this issue. And it's something that, as a society, we've reached pretty much a social consensus on this, in the fact that all 50 states ban dog fighting and cock fighting. In fact, all 50 states punish dog fighting as a felony, 37 punish cock fighting as a felony, and 13 as a misdemeanor. And it's one of those things where now it's about enforcement and influencing the small number of people that are still likely to get involved in this sort of thing. Now, humorously, there are some that just don't get it. It's a little restaurant that when I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, called the Dog Pit. I don't think they had any idea when they named their hot dog stand the Dog Pit that someone like me would think, Dog Pit? Well, that's where they fight dogs at. But it just goes to show that sometimes when you're coming up with names for your business, you might be a little bit more careful. Now, Mr. Vick here, he certainly did a lot to help put that spotlight on animal fighting. And when you watch the news accounts of the things that investigators discovered, and you see some of the graphic descriptions of cruelty, of how dogs that would not perform well in practice fights were killed, that's a dark, dark cloud. However, this case had a very, very significant silver lining. When this first came and broke in the news in late April of 2007, we realized at the HSUS that the dogfighting issue was never going to be treated the same again, because now this animal cruelty crime had a public face on it. And we wanted to do far more than just see this case to its conclusion. We wanted to capitalize on the momentum, on the sense of urgency and the newfound awareness to advance the cause to eradicate animal fighting from the United States. So in the past year, we really went to work trying to capitalize on that momentum. We had a long-standing reward fund where we would give people up to $2,500 when they brought information that led to the arrest and conviction of someone for animal fighting. We doubled that to $5,000 last summer, the summer of 2007, when this case was still pending. We needed to get the word out about that. So far, 16 attorney generals of 16 different states, as well as some other important people, like, for example, the U.S. attorney from Hawaii, a congressman at large from Delaware, have held news conferences with us to promote this reward fund and to commit their offices to doing everything they can to combating these animal cruelty crimes. Just through this reward program alone, 24 tips have already led to arrests and prosecutions, and there are a lot more out there pending. We're also promoting it very heavily among the dog fighters. We've got a couple tricks up our sleeves that are going to be rolling out in the next month that are certainly going to have a little bit of a psychological impact among their ranks. But we want to make sure that all of the people that are involved in that criminal industry are aware. You make $5,000 by giving the information. We've also capitalized on this in the legislative arena. Idaho and Wyoming, at the time of the Michael Vick's arrest, were still punishing dogfighting as a misdemeanor. Immediately, when they came into session in 2008, they passed laws to make it a felony. Georgia, at the time, was the only state where it was both legal to attend a dogfight and also legal to possess a dog with the intent to fight. Their legislature had spent 3 years hemming and hawing and coming up with excuses why not to toughen their dogfighting law, to bring their law in line with that of all of their neighbors, and in fact, all of the country. With this spotlight on, if they could not hold back any longer, they went ahead and passed a good, tough new animal fighting law. And already, there have been 8 major dogfighting kennels that have been shut down in that state just in the past 4 or 5 months since that law went into effect. The United States Congress also got involved. We had, right about the time that Vick was arrested, we had succeeded in passing a law in the United States Congress that made it a federal felony to have any interstate transport of an animal for an animal fighting venture. The burden on federal prosecutors, though, was to prove that there had been some interstate movement of an animal for an animal fighting venture. With passage of the Farm Bill this year, there was language that was inserted into that bill that changed that law and reduced the burden on federal prosecutors. Now, instead of a federal prosecutor and federal investigators having to show that there is some interstate movement of an animal to make an animal fighting case at the federal level, all they have to do is show that interstate commerce has been affected. Well, if you're in Illinois breeding dogs or roosters for fighting, even if those animals never cross the state line, even if they're only fought against animals that were born, bred, conditioned, and fought in this state, the dog food was bagged at a Purina Mills facility in Missouri, you bought it and fed it to your dog, interstate commerce is affected. So now it's become significantly easier for federal prosecutors to make animal fighting cases, and also the penalties were jacked up from a maximum of 3 years in prison to a maximum of 5 years in prison. That's particularly important when you're considering that these are gambling crimes in many cases, at least at the high-end organized level of dogfighting. And, you know, these guys are going to sit there and look and outweigh the consequences. Well, if I'm facing a misdemeanor slap on the wrist, if I can win $10,000 at the dogfight, we'll take that risk. But when the penalty offsets the gain that comes from being involved in the crime, that changes it altogether. Additionally, in 2008, 14 state legislatures strengthen their animal fighting laws. Obviously, Idaho and Wyoming making it a felony in Georgia, but then 11 others as well. In Illinois, they increased the penalties for being a spectator at a dogfight. I haven't updated this map in a couple of months. Illinois should be, I believe it should be red now, at least for the second offense. But with dogfighting being a felony in 50 states, we wanted to increase the penalties for the spectators for two reasons. Number one, these people finance these illegal activities by when they pay admission fees to get into the matches. And number two, the spectator provision, when it's treated as a misdemeanor, can be a big loophole. Imagine a dogfight. 6 different people are brought dogs to fight that night, so 3 matches. The police raid and 2 of the guys are in the pit fighting dogs with the referee. The other 4, knowing dogfighting is a felony, but knowing being a spectator is a misdemeanor, can easily say, that's not my dog in the kennel over there, I was just a spectator. So they've used that as a loophole to avoid the more meaningful penalties. So for that reason, we've been going state by state trying to increase the penalties for a spectator provision. The only state where spectators remains legal is up there in Montana. They don't have a very active dogfighting scene there, but you know, we'll hope to close that loophole as well. We've also been working to train law enforcement in the past year. Over 2,000 police officers, it's actually now about 2,200 in the last year, have been trained on how to investigate animal fighting, what the paraphernalia that animal fighters use to prepare animals for fight looks like, how it's used so they can sit on the witness stand and give real top-notch testimony to help secure convictions, and also we go into investigative technique. And we have several law enforcement officers that go around and give the training classes. And it's been real successful. Every time we do one of these, something happens in that community. We did one in Kansas, and next thing you know, both places breeding dogs for fighting was raided and a big cockfighting pit was raided. Went to Minnesota, same thing. I mean, it's, you know, that program's been very, very successful. And raids are up. These beautiful people right here are three defendants from a case in Arizona. This one right here, his name's Pat Patrick. These were some of the three most well-known, infamous breeders of fighting dogs in the United States. Their operations were raided in February of this year in the Tucson, Arizona area, Pima County. 150 dogs were seized and about 50 or 60 firearms and just a whole mess of things. And let me tell you something, that place was a dump. The Pat Patrick and Emily Dennis, their significant others lived together out in the desert, and they had these kennels set up. Most dog fighters will have the dogs on a chain set up where they drive an axle, a car axle into the ground and have a logging chain and a big thick collar to keep the dogs restrained. This particular county, though, has an ordinance prohibiting tethering, prohibiting the chaining of a dog for 24 hours a day. So they set up these kennels, and, you know, cement floor, you know, fencing and all of that. And in between two of these kennels is a big, long, it's like a little puddle that went about 15 feet. It was foaming green. It was the only standing body of water in the southern Arizona that I could find. And I just kind of goes to show what kind of folks these guys are. But since the Vic case, we've tabulated the numbers. We looked at all dogfighting cases that happened in 2006, the first 9 months of 2006. And then compared them to the first 9 months of 2008. So you have the Vic case in 2007, and then three quarters completed this year compared to the same three quarters from the year prior to the Vic thing. We found that the number of dogs seized and dogfighting raids has doubled. The number of raids themselves have doubled. And the number of people arrested in dogfighting crimes is actually up 150%. The reason that the numbers of people arrested is up more than the raids is because they've hit some of these fights that have had large numbers of people present. So we have seen, in the wake of the Vic case, some real good activity to help put these folks out of business. Now, the number one challenge that animal groups have when working with law enforcement to make a dogfighting raid happen is where to put the dogs while the case is working its way through the court system. And in a lot of states, they have a bonding provision where an accused animal abuser or accused dog fighter, cockfighter, whatever, can be ordered to pay a bond to cover the cost of feeding and housing those animals while the case makes its way through the criminal justice system. And the logic is the guy's going to be paying for the animal's feed anyway. If it's on his property, they should go ahead and pay for their feed too while they're in an animal shelter instead of the burden falling to a municipality. Because some of these cases can get extremely expensive when you've got 60 dogs and you're holding them for a year. Now, there are some places, though, that don't have those sort of provisions. So working with a foundation in Georgia that's very committed to eradicating dog fighting, we set up the grant program where when you have a large number of animals that are brought in on an animal fighting case, you can get a grant from us to help offset the costs feeding and housing them. Now, this is something that's aimed at the more rural, low-budget shelters that just don't have the facilities to handle all of these animals that can be seized in these sort of raids, because we spoke with sheriffs in some rural county, in particular in a rural county in Mississippi, who said, I, myself and a lot of my colleagues around the state would be doing these raids all the time if we just had something to do with all the animals. So we're like, okay, that's what you need. We'll step up and we'll take care of that. That hurdle's gone. So now that excuse out of the way, hopefully more and more of these raids will start to happen. I'm going to let Theo talk about the Chicago pilot program, which is expanded into Atlanta and Charlotte. That's a very, very unique program. It's never been tried before. It is bearing some fruit, and I think it's going to have a big impact on reducing dogfighting in these cities. Now, dogfighting isn't the only form of animal fighting out there. There's also cockfighting. That's a felony in the state of Illinois. And for those of you that don't know what it is, it's basically a knife fight between roosters. They actually will cut the heels off, the spurs off the back of the rooster's heel. On the back of their leg, they have a natural little spur about an inch and a half long. They'll saw that off, and then in the cockfight, they'll tie on a weapon. They'll have a gaff, which is like a curved ice pick, a long knife, which is what this is, it's about 2.5 to 3 inches in length, or a short knife, which is about 1 inch in length. And the birds are oftentimes given adrenaline-boosting substances, blood-clotting agents, and they're pitted against one another, and they fight to death. And they have some very large establishments where these happen, and particularly in the states where cockfighting is still punished as a misdemeanor. This is a cockfighting pit from Tennessee. In the back, you can see all the bleacher seating. They had the same bleacher seating on the other side where the person taking the photograph was standing. They could hold about 500 paying spectators and cockfighters. Off to the side, you'll see on each side, they have another little pit that has a board in between. So that way, if a fight in the center ring is going on too long, they can move it to one of those little bitty pits. They call it a drag pit. This has been dragging on and on. They can get up to 5 fights going at one time. This particular cockfighting pit was raided by the FBI in June of 2007. Now, you may be wondering, why is the FBI raiding a cockfighting pit? You know, I mean, they generally deal with white-collar crime, terrorism, public corruption, things like that, whereas the USDA generally deals with federal animal fighting violations. Well, the reason was because the sheriff was taking bribes from the cockfighters and turning his head while they operated this pit. It was one of the largest illegal cockfighting pits in the nation. And that sort of public corruption had a corrosive effect where first the sheriff's turning his head to something he considered to be a lesser crime. Then another group comes along, people that ran the brothels. All right, well, took a little bit of money, turned his head away from that as well. Then some chop shops, and it had a corrosive effect on public, law enforcement in that county. Got to the point where 6 deputies were indicted. One of them was arrested by FBI after selling an undercover agent a big block of cocaine, a brick of cocaine, I think that's what they call it. And, you know, it just goes to the point that we've made in some of these states down south where we're lobbying for felony cockfighting, you know, it just has a corrosive effect on law enforcement there when they turn their head to these sorts of things and they treat these things as if they're not a problem. In fact, just 2 weeks ago in Virginia, where I live, the sheriff of Page County was arrested by U.S. Attorney's Office, indicted him, and he was arrested for exact same thing, taking bribes from the cockfighters, turning his head, and then, you know, that led to some other things, like sexually assaulting 12 different female employees, etc. It seems that all these guys can't be involved in this one bad thing at a time. But the good thing about this particular pit, it was raided, it was shut down, and the FBI agent that led this investigation is retired now and formed a private investigative firm, a very elite investigative firm, and we've taken him on. The Humane Society of the United States has become their primary client, and they're working with us to target animal fighting throughout the rural southeastern United States. So, you know, it's a really great relationship that came from working on that case. Now, that particular county where this place was based is called Cock County. I'm not kidding. But it's C-O-C-K-E. It's named after a man named William Cock. That said, the school mascot of Cock County, Fighting Cocks. Can you believe that? There are some areas of the country that still don't get it. And it's particularly interesting because you got this little sign here, you know, Cock County High School, home of the Fighting Cocks, that way. Then you see little mini underneath there, Newport Animal Shelter, also that way. Shows where their priorities are there in Cock County, Tennessee. This is what the cockfighting laws in the United States look like. The red states are where it's punished as a felony. The blue states are where it's punished as a misdemeanor. We've got a lot of these states in our sights for the 2009 legislative session. We want to bring these laws up so they're consistent with the dogfighting laws. We do find that when we get the stronger penalties, that it shakes a lot of these guys out of this particular business. Illinois had been a state where it was a felony on the second offense. In 2007, the penalty was upgraded so it would be a felony on the first offense. And that was after a raid in Rockford, where over 100 people were arrested in a big cockfighting pit, and they found that the lion's share had come from Wisconsin, Michigan, and Indiana. presumably because cockfighting was a felony on the first offense in those states. And, hey, you know what? These guys go jurisdiction shopping. They look for the places with the weaker penalties. That's where they go. And fortunately, though, that incident led to the legislature increasing the penalties and turning off the magnet, so hopefully those folks won't be attracted to this state to commit that crime here. Now, being that you're law students, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the different bits of litigation that we're involved in that pertain to animal fighting. There actually have been a bunch of DVDs that have been circulated during recent years of dogfights, just raw footage of dogfights, and also some of cockfights. But the dogfighting ones, like this one, Unleashed, the Realest Pit Bull Action Caught on Tape, were distributed at some gas stations, flea markets, just, you know, obscure stores. And this was in violation of federal law because in 1999, the Congress passed a law that banned the commercial sale of a video depiction of animal cruelty for commercial gain. Now, this was passed because of pornographic videos that were circulating of women in high heels crushing small animals. They call them crush videos, believe it or not. There's actually, somehow, a market for that. I don't understand it either. Well, we got that law passed, and we were also able to apply it to the dogfighting videos. Now, a dogfighter in Virginia named Bob Stevens was arrested and prosecuted and for distributing dogfighting videos, and he had challenged the constitutionality of the law. That the constitutionality was upheld in the lower court, but the appeals court overturned the law. They said it was unconstitutional to prohibit animal snuff films. We're working with the U.S. Attorney's Office, encouraging them to, and it looks like they are going to appeal that up to the Supreme Court so we can get that law put back into effect and stop the proliferation of these animal snuff films. I mean, it's not, you know, political speech or art or anything like that. It's just raw footage of animals tearing each other to pieces. So that's one bit of litigation that we're involved in. Also, federal law prohibits the use of the United States Postal Service or any other interstate instrumentality. It prohibits using those avenues, post office or any other interstate instrumentality, in furtherance of an illegal animal fighting venture. This would apply to people that mail out the schedules for their animal fighting pit. It also, we believe, applies to magazines that contain commercial advertisements where they sell animals for the express purpose of fighting, and also implements that are used like the gas and knives used in cockfights, adrenaline-boosting drugs, etc., etc. We petitioned the United States Postal Service because they were providing not only service for shipping out three monthly cockfighting magazines, but also giving them a bulk mail discount. So we petitioned them to revoke that, pointing out that it was illegal to use the United States Postal Service for those purposes. Now, they responded without referencing any law, just denying our petition. What they don't seem to realize is that commercial speech is not protected when it's being used to further illegal activities. And these magazines are basically like catalogs filled with advertisements, a handful of articles. Not a surprise, most animal fighters are illiterate and can't write good articles. a lot of advertisements helping people break the law. So we sued the United States Postal Service, and based on the questions the judge has been asking and supplemental information that's been having to be provided, I think we're probably going to win that and help shut some of these magazines down. Also, the cockfighters have filed a lawsuit through this little front group they formed called the United Gamefowl Breeders Association, challenging the federal law on animal fighting. And I'm not kidding. This is actually a quote from the article the Columbus Dispatch in Columbus, Ohio wrote about the cockfighters' lawsuit to throw the law out. They actually said fighting animals lowered their stress and helped them live longer. I feel pretty good that we're going to defeat their lawsuit. They're also challenging recent bans in New Mexico and Louisiana on cockfighting. And so, you know, we're actively doing everything we can, you know, filing amicus briefs and such, and working with the Attorney General offices in those states to defend those bans. bans. Every time we've gotten a, now that cockfighting's banned in all 50 states, I point to the history. They challenge bans in state after state after state. They throw good money after bad. That's fine by me. We don't mind that. You know, I feel pretty good that they'll get upheld. But our Animal Protection Litigation Department is certainly busy with all of this stuff that's going on, not to mention all the work that's going on with other animal protection issues. Now, I feel good about the progress that we're making against animal fighters, both dogfighting and cockfighting. Here's a quote from the Gamecock magazine. I loved this one. They can't do that, but they are doing it, and on a much more regular basis than ever before. And I had to fix the spelling on that. So where do we go from here? Well, these are some of the projects that we're involved in, and I encourage other people that care about this particular cause to be involved in. You know, obviously, we want to get the laws to be good everywhere. We're almost there. Just a few more states to go. The Expand Urban Outreach Programs, that references what Tio is going to tell you about with all the good work that he's doing. You know, getting information out there about our reward materials, forming task forces, and just being engaged in communities, because we're making progress, and I can tell that their numbers are declining, at least in a lot of areas where we're putting an emphasis. I want to continue with that. And this is a picture of a little gamecock that from a raid in Kansas this past summer. And I picked him up and took him out there for the TV camera to get a little shot of him. But I always put that slide in there because it kind of reminds me why we do what we do. Here's my contact information. Tio's up next. Did you all want us to do the questions now or afterwards? Wait till afterwards? Okay, great. All right. Yeah.
Give me a minute.
Yeah, same deal.
Thanks, man.
Probably have some questions until I get this set up. No. Here we go. Come on. Quick. As I thought it would be. Okay. Okay.
All right, first of all, how's everybody doing today? Okay, my name is T.O. Harvey. I'm a special consultant with the Humane Society of the United States and dog fighting campaign across the United States. And I've been working in the field of violence prevention for the last maybe 12 years of my career. The campaign itself is picking up a lot of momentum right now because we're working in Atlanta and Charlotte, but it all started right here in Chicago. By working in the field of violence prevention, I began to realize that pit bull dogs were present 30% of the time while I was out there working, trying to disrupt, you know, guys in the gang lifestyle from fighting one another and killing one another. So I had to pay attention to the animals as well. You know, blessed are the peacemakers. I love pit bull dogs myself, and I began to take on this here, champion this cause, because before Michael Vick got caught up, pit bull dog fighting has been going on for about 30 years, really. They first started out fighting Dobermans, and then one time or another they fought Rottweilers, so now the pit bull just happens to be the most prominent dog as far as the pit bull dog fighting throughout the United States right now. So dog fighting stats. There are more than 40,000 active dog fighters nationwide. When I talk about 40,000 active dog fighters, we're talking about guys that are involved in level 3, which is that sophisticated interstate traveling fighting dogs, the kennels, and the, you know, the backyard breeders, and the people that fight on the high level. But there are three levels of dog fighting here in the United States. You have level 1 is mainly you have the young guys that fight the dogs just because they feel the pit bull dogs were born to fight. they bump them in the front yard and they try to just make them go that extra mile. A lot of pit bull dogs, 95% of pit bull dogs are non-human aggressive. It's just a lot of times they get a bad, you know, stigma placed on them, like they're so aggressive all the time. It's how you train them and socialize the dogs. So, but there are more than 40,000 active dog fighters. Every year, hundreds of thousands of dogs become victims of the blood sport. A lot of times in the inner city, the average lifespan of an inner city pit bull dog is 18 months. That's the lifespan of an inner city pit bull. Because if the guys fight the dogs and the dog ends up losing the fight, they end up killing the dog or they throw the dog away, and then the animal care control has to pick the dog up. They have no other choice but to put the dog to sleep because the dog is kind of aggressive. And a lot of people won't adopt pit bulls if they're too aggressive. Okay, dogs suffer from painful mutilation and often death. I just talked about that. Dog fighting associated with other crimes. A lot of guys in the gangs here in Chicago, throughout the United States, they might train the pit bull dogs. For example, if the police come and try to arrest some of the guys, the dogs, they've been trained to attack the police officers and bite them in the groin area, you know, to try to keep so they can throw their drugs away. So the pit bull dogs are so loyal to their master, like most animals, okay? They exploit the pit bull dogs in a lot of ways. That's what it really comes down to. It's a multi-million dollar underground industry. That is what it's all about. A lot of people are making money on pit bull dogs. And I just talked about the levels of dog fighting. I've hired some guys, we call them anti-dog fighting advocates. These are the guys that go out on the streets every day here on the west side of Chicago. And right now we work in the 5th District as well in the Roseland community. And they go out and try to talk guys down from fighting their dogs and try to intervene in dog fights sometimes. A lot of times it's the role of the police to intervene in the dog fights. But we have guys that have influence in the community who the young guys kind of look up to. I call them credible messengers, guys that might be able to make sense out of the madness. And since we've been doing this work since 2006, I must admit that we've intervened in about at least 25 to 30 dog fights right in the middle of the dog fight occurring. It's not easy work because the guys on the streets will tell you in a minute, get out of our business, we got to do what we have to do. A lot of those guys are not making money on level one, impromptu dog fighting. You know, the main signs of dog fighting, you see blood in the backyard, you see a circle like, you know, in the backyard, tires hanging out of a tree, broken treadmills in the garage, you know, so those are some of the signs. These heavy chains on the dogs, and obviously dogs that are really scarred up real bad. I saw a dog one time, I don't be so graphic, but this dog, his whole half of his face was torn apart. And this dog was just sitting in the yard, he didn't know what, just sitting there looking crazy. You know, it gets really rough out there. And on level two, you have the guys that might fight for anywhere from like $200 to maybe $1,500. They don't make a lot of money. Level two dog fighters make a lot of money breeding the dogs, though. Some of those dogs, they come from a real strong bloodline. They can make anywhere from $500 to $1,500 per dog. So it's in their best interest to keep breeding the dogs. I've seen some situations where you come to somebody's house, they have dogs in these big crates in their basement, like anywhere from $15 in one little bitty crate all together, little puppies, and the mothers in the crate with them. It gets kind of rough for these pit bulls out here across America. In level three, we talked about the professional, highly organized bloodline records, published match reports. I once met a dog, I must say his dog, the name of the dog was, they called him the King, they called him Big King. This dog was a very well-known, established fighting dog. This dog was worth $100,000. Big King was something else, but he was retired. He was a retired fighting dog. You can see all the scars in his face, though. This dog was something else, but he was revered as this here image, you know, for the pit bull dog fighters on the level three, you know, fighting rings. And the work that Humane Society is doing with John Goode and everybody else, it's hard to really penetrate that high level. Level three, level one and two, you can penetrate it a little bit better. It takes a lot of resources to penetrate level three, you know. And then you have, like, these are just some of the pictures, the graphics of how the dogs look. And the worst thing that you can really encounter out there is when you see little puppies being put into these dog fighting, you know, situations where these little puppies can't even really speak up for themselves. I had a situation where I rescued a dog. All the dogs I've kind of rescued and taken out of the situations, I give them names like Baby Blue is this little puppy. And they're about to throw this little puppy in this yard with these three older dogs. And you can tell the puppy's heart was beating like maybe 100 beats per second. You know, this puppy was really, really terrified. I got him out of their hands and I don't have a picture of them up here, but these are just some of the pictures of how these dogs look. And these dogs end up being put down across America as well because nobody wants to take them in. Now, I must admit, the Michael Vick dogs, I think they only had to put one dog down. A lot of agencies stepped up, like Bad Rap Up in California, and a few other agencies took the dogs in, you know. So you would think that the dogs are so rough. And DMX, as we talk about hip-hop, and the influence hip-hop has had with promoting the stereotypes with pit bull dogs. You know, DMX has been arrested before in the past, you know, for having fighting dogs. And he still, every now and then, he still may kind of like, you know, promote or try to push dog fighting or, you know, negative dog ownership. So we try to promote healthy dog ownership. That's what it's all about. It's okay to own a dog, but the thing is, if you don't have the resources to take care of the pit bull or any animal, you shouldn't own the dog. That's what it comes down to. So DMX, he's been in the newspaper several times. And this is what it's all about, what we're doing. Combating dog fighting in Chicago. The anti-dog fighting advocates, we offer a pit bull dog training, a positive training for all the young men in the community. So when I started working with the Humane Society of the United States, they wanted me to go out to these high-risk communities. So what I did is I went right out there and got the real deal. This particular dog here that's eating this little doggy cake, he graduated with his good canine citizenship award, his owner, and his name is Diesel. But when we first encountered Diesel, he wouldn't even sit in the room. He couldn't stay calm for nothing. Any dog he would see, he would try to attack. And now Diesel is one of the most calmest dogs in Chicago, I must admit. And he is, and very calm. You know, the trainer that I work with, his name is Jeff Jenkins. He's done a marvelous job training some of these aggressive dogs. For example, what we do every Saturday at 1 o'clock, and any of the students here, feel free to come out and check our training out. It's pretty good. We've been covered in the USA Today newspaper. We've been covered in a lot of magazines throughout the United States. I've done a lot of interviews on the news. I'm working with the History Channel right now on a big piece on the work that we're doing. But Diesel, and there's an agitation dog named Lola. What we would do is we'd line all the pit bull dogs up together, and these are dogs that used to devour other dogs. And Lola would agitate the dogs, and they can't make a move. You should see their faces. They're like, man, I got to do something. And they can't make a move, so it's a good thing. So we train the dogs, along with their owners, how to be positive and handle their dogs the right way. That's what it comes down to. Diesel was one of our first graduates. That's one to highlight Diesel there. And these are some of the young guys that work with us. This young kid up here who has a dog in his arms, he, believe it or not, he used to fight dogs on level one. Level one. He didn't know what he was doing. So we began to do some outreach to the community, met with this young guy, talked with his mother. When I encountered this young guy, they were fighting puppies in the front yard. Just fighting the puppies. A few of the puppies weren't even trying to fight. They were just trying to make them fight. They were kicking them and everything. Fight, you better fight. So to make a long story short, he started participating in our training, and now he's one of the successful people that has completed the training. And Sean, the young man here, his dog's name is Jigger. When I first met Sean, he was connected to a fighting ring here in Chicago on level two. And he can give his testimony better than I can. However, Sean was connected to about maybe 100 guys here in Chicago that own pit bull dogs. And they all used to fight their dogs. And now Sean is working with me as an anti-dog fighting advocate, and he's really turning it around. All the guys he was connected to, now they're coming to the training. Not all of them, but about 15 at a time. So he's really making it happen. And Sean has been featured throughout the United States as well in some of the magazine articles. I think it helps his morale out, you know, builds his reputation of trying to turn his life around. So Jigger is a very well-disciplined dog. And Sean's best friend, his name is Hassan. He named his dog Homicide. And since he's been participating in the training, he changed his name to just Sai. Okay. There's no more Homicide. I just want to make that clear. So his dog's name is Sai right now. Okay, so this is some pretty good work we're doing because we're changing hearts and we're changing minds. There is like a hip-hop component, and Lloyd Maxwell, who's in Washington, D.C., we got a chance to connect with DMC and LL Cool J up in New York City, and DMC stepped up for us. He began to host events for us. He hosted our Hip-Hop for Hounds event, and right now we're still going to try to get a little bit more work out of DMC and LL Cool J because they're interested and really stepping up with the campaign. But the work we're doing in Atlanta and Charlotte is really picking up. I was really amazed how the community is so happy to hear about a program like this because nobody else talked about this before and taking it straight forward to the guys. I've had young men and women both come to me and say, you know what, nobody ever in my life talked to me about not fighting the dogs, which is very important. And the program we're working with now, it's been proven to be successful. Since 2006, in the Austin community, the level of arrests for dog fighting, per se, the level is going down, plus the level of calls for dog fighting is going down as well, which is good because what happens when the people are not fighting the dogs, you won't have a high level of arrests, and at the same time, the people are not being called. And because it's hard to catch dog fighting, first of all, a lot of guys fight the dogs in their basements or whatever the case may be. And believe it or not, when they caught up with Michael Vick, they were really looking to try to execute a warrant for marijuana. And they stumbled across that big dog fighting ring at his estate there. And I just want to thank you all. I made like a short presentation. How much more time do we have?
We have a few more minutes before we
can
do some questions.
All right, that's cool. I want to leave room for Q&A. But the campaign is on the move. You can always go on the Humane Society of the United States website and look up Illinois and look up my name as well on the computer search. Do a Google search on my name, T.O. Hardeman. I've been involved in violence prevention for a while, but I'm glad to be connected with the Humane Society because the sky is the limit. And I see these dogs changing in their behaviors, and I see these young men out in the community spreading the word. And it's not easy to get 12 to 15 young men to come to a training every Saturday for 8 weeks. And complete the training is more important because it's just not easy. These are guys that don't have proper leases for their dogs. They can't get the dogs the shots. We're setting up sessions where we can get them the shots and all kinds of good things like that in the community. For example, I was out of town in Charlotte about 3 weeks ago, and we had organized a shot clinic for one day, and we had an overwhelming turnout. We had almost 50 young men that came there with their dogs. And you know, the dogs were scared to get them shots. You had some of the biggest, toughest dogs in the world. They were like just tearing the place up. They didn't want to get microchipped or get their shots. But these are tough dogs. And another thing about pit bulls, I want to say this to you. I'm watching the training as the dogs first come in. These are some pretty tough-looking dogs. Do you know they're scared to walk across a ladder? They're scared to sit up on a crate. But if you look at them, they're pretty tough. But as time goes by, you begin to see them develop confidence in certain key areas. So that's what the training is all about. And like I said before I conclude, you can go online and you can see some video footage of the training as well. It's an end-dog fighting video up there on YouTube. Punch my name there, you see all the work that we're doing. So I want to thank you all for having me to come out.
Questions?
Any questions? Yeah.
I have a question, and I'm not saying it may not reflect my own personal views, but is there a risk of over-criminalizing some activity? Because it seems like the dog fighting crimes are a little, I guess, disproportionate to other animal abuse crimes, like thoroughbred breeding, greyhounds, and livestock.
Well, I think that, and I certainly believe that greyhound racing, for example, should be outlawed for a number of things that happen in that particular industry. That is illegal in 34 states. Now, dogfighting and cockfighting, though, we push for felony-level penalties on those because of their gambling crimes where there's a unique profitability. And what we found is for us to, for the laws to have a deterrent effect, the penalty has to offset the profit that can come from being involved. So if you removed the profit element, then it'd be a different debate. But our viewpoint is that, like, for example, in Alabama, where the maximum fine for cockfighting is $50, but some of those derbies where all the entries pool their money together, and then someone wins all that money pooled together, they can walk away with $10,000 or $15,000. Well, why wouldn't they break that law regularly? I mean, $50 if you get caught, $10,000 to $15,000 if you don't get caught, you'll win.
But the same argument would be made for racing as well, right? I mean, those people are saying you have TV contracts off track bets. So there's more of a gambling element there.
Well, there's a lot of gambling, certainly in dog racing and horse racing. Of course, they wouldn't have the TV element if you didn't have the if it was illegal. But I believe that dog fighting and cock fighting are significantly more cruel than horse racing, though. You know, dog fight ends generally with an animal dead. Cock fight ends with an animal dead. Horse race doesn't end with an animal dead. So I also think that they're more severe forms of animal cruelty.
I'm from Miami with this pit bull ban, and it was grandfathered in because it was passing 9 in 1990. The great specific bans were unconstitutional before the law, but you know, it's already been in place. And I saw lots of pit bulls get put to sleep, wonderful, lovely dogs. The owners got ticketed for something minor, like not picking up the dog's droppings. The police officer saw that it was a pit bull type dog, and I saw a lot of really wonderful dogs that you know, get because of these kind of blanket bans that seem to be in response to dog fighting, but I think weren't really in response to, you know. And then how is the Humane Society working with that? I mean, you talked about bad rap in California.
Right. You want to say that?
Yeah, that sounds good. Those are actually not done in response to dogfighting, but city council's fears about dangerous dogs. None of them have ever been passed in response to dogfighting. You know, we oppose breed-specific bans and lobbied, like, for example, just in 2008, Florida, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Ohio, and I think one other state had legislation introduced at the state level to ban certain types of dogs, and we lobbied to defeat all of them. I do think, though, that if we can deal with the dog fighting problem, it's going to take a lot of the scarlet letter off of the pit bull terriers, that scarlet letter off their forehead, and I think that will reduce some of the pressure. And also probably get dogs out of the hands of some irresponsible folks that may be contributing incidents that fuel those bans.
Right, just to add to that, you're right also because in Charlotte, North Carolina, for example, they put down about $13,000 a year, and 55 to 60% are pit bull dogs. So we have to be mindful as we challenge this particular issue and make sure that we look out for the survival of the breed as well. So a lot of times these dogs get put down. I'm talking about really puppies, but in a lot of cases people do stuff up. It's just an overwhelming issue with pit bull dogs. A lot of people will not adopt them out. And some of the shelters won't even get a chance. If they just keep the dog forever and ever, and eventually somebody has to make a decision. And trust me, I never would talk this way maybe a couple years ago, because I don't believe in putting dogs down, but my mind changed just a little bit. I just want to say a little bit, because I'm looking at the overall issue. I won't put a dog down personally, but I know the shelters have to put them down, because as soon as you put one dog down, another dog comes right in. And it's crazy. I'm talking about it's really crazy. I would hope that we as a country can really, you know, raise up and address this issue head on and find out a way that we can kind of get the dogs spayed and neutered is a good way to try to really cut down on the population. Because 80% of the young men and women across America that own pit bulls are responsible owners. It's that small percentage that own the dogs on the street level. For example, I had a 10-year-old kid call me on a Sunday evening around 9 p.m. He left me a message. T.O.T., you got to get over here right now. There's a pit bull under the car. The guys are throwing bricks at him. The dog was severely dehydrated, and the dog really didn't know what to do, and they killed the dog on the street. By the time I got over there, I put him in my back seat, and he died on the way to the hospital. You know? So it's just, it's tragic. It is what it is, but we can only do the best we can.
Yeah.
You have to quit. Any more questions?
Yes. As you said, I know that Humane Society was active in trying to get, I think it was Amazon, to stop selling the game bird magazines. What was the, has there been any success in that area, or is Amazon still continuing to sell game cock and these types of...
This question relates to the question about our the United States Postal Service lawsuit as well. The Gamecock, we had sued Amazon.com, the Gamecock magazine, and the Feathered Warrior magazine for the same reasons and basis as the Postal Service lawsuit I talked about earlier. Gamecock magazine settled out of court and removed a whole bunch of their advertising, then asked Amazon to pull their magazine off their website. Amazon did pull their magazine off the website and also pulled the Feathered Warrior off, even though the litigation against Amazon and the Feathered Warrior is still pending. We don't know if they pulled that second magazine by mistake or on purpose, and we haven't asked their counsel about it yet because, you know, if it was a mistake, we didn't want them to turn around and just put it right back on there. But that's also pending litigation, just like the U.S. Postal Service thing, and I expect that to come to conclusion soon. But if the court rules in our favor and orders the post office to honor our petition to deem those magazines non-mailable and remove their bulk mail permit, it'll make that case moot. Anyone else have any questions for either T.O. or myself?
Yeah.
The states that have resisted making it a felony, the legislators that resisted, are they responding to constituent pressure, or why?
Yeah, this is a great question, actually, because there's 13 states where cockfighting is still a felony. We're at 50 states with dogfighting. The FBI agent, the retired FBI agent that we just recently hired that had done the case in Cobb County, he was still at the FBI last April, and we were able to get the legislature to give him a subpoena to come testify about a felony cockfighting bill in Tennessee. And one thing he revealed is that in 1989, Tennessee did make cockfighting a felony and then switch it back to a misdemeanor in 1990. It's felony law for 1 year. Now, what he said, this is FBI agent's testimony, is that when they had investigated a former state legislator who they imprisoned for being involved in narcotics trafficking, they also learned that he had taken a $30,000 bribe from the cockfighters in exchange for doing his best to get that law taken back down to a misdemeanor level. So the cockfighters were paying off this legislator, and he was never prosecuted on it. was they locked him up in the narcotics instead and called it a day. But that's a pretty powerful incentive to, for one of these lawmakers to work against us. And it gets back to this gentleman, your question earlier, too. The cockfighters paid $30,000 for a misdemeanor law because they can live with that. It was a felony law that put them out of business. And so that's one argument that we, are making to the legislators there. You know, these guys are happy. They'll pay $30,000. They don't mind being criminalized. They just don't want a penalty that offsets the gain that comes from breaking the law. The other aspect of that is that usually these cockfighting bills get assigned to a state, to a, either House or Senate Agriculture Committee. And agriculture committees generally have legislators from rural areas, and the cockfighters generally live in rural areas. So sometimes they are just responding to certain people in their district. Now, we do try to turn that on its head by saying, look, when these cockfighters show up at a legislative hearing to oppose the bill to strengthen the penalty, we say, look, obviously, the fact that you've got 100 guys here that admit they're involved in this crime and are begging you to keep the penalties weak so they can continue to break the law and just get slapped on the wrist is an argument for exactly why you should deny their request and pass a stronger law. But I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. And first, just to add to it, it's very important to get the community involved. That's one of the components of the dogfighting campaign as well, getting overwhelming support from the community at large when you're addressing legislators and lawmakers. Yeah.
So I guess my last question would be, why isn't regulation and sanctioning seen as an answer? Because I think if you look back to the prohibition period with thoroughbred racing and dog racing, it was pretty much tied to bootlegging and other illegal activities. And now that's more or less sanctioned, and I guess for the most part, those kind of activities are outside of the business now. So why wouldn't you have a different model for how to just increase the lives of, the longevity of the lives of dogs, animal treatment over time, regularly?
Well, it wouldn't work because the dog fight or the cock fight, they call the roosters game cocks, and they call the dogs game dogs. Game in both names being a derivative of the word gameness. The dogfight or a cockfight is a test of an animal's gameness, the one that has the willingness to continue fighting even when severely hurt, even when severely injured, that will fight all the way, no matter how exhausted or how much in pain, and defeat his opponent is the one that's the gameness and wins the fight. Those are also the ones that are held back for breeding. So you really can't have animal fighting without immense pain and suffering. I mean, it's intertwined like strands of DNA. So we wouldn't favor any form of legalization, no matter how stringent the regulations, because that cruelty would be alive and sanctioned. And, I thought I almost made a comment when we were talking about the crush videos about something my dad once said when we were talking about cultural norms and, what's legal and illegal. And he said, and I shared his opinion, and this is just my personal opinion, it's not necessarily the opinion of any side of the United States, but I believe that what makes a culture or a society sick is not what happens in the shadows, but what is accepted, is okay and normal. And I would just feel that if we went that route and accepted these as legal activities, that we'd be putting ourselves in a bad moral position.
All right, thank you.
Do you have any idea how many subscribers there are to those newsletters?
Yes. The dogfighting magazines, there was one called the Sporting Dog Journal that had about 4,000 subscribers. The publishers of that magazine were prosecuted. The most widespread dogfighting magazines today have about 400. Most of the dogfighters have gotten away from magazines. They talk a lot on the Internet. The cockfighting magazines, the Gamecock, 10 years ago they had 16,000 subscribers. Today they have 6,000. The middle one, the Grit and Steel, has about 4,000 subscribers, and the Feathered Warrior has about 1,800 subscribers. And we know the numbers on the dogfighting magazine just through investigations, but you may remember that I mentioned that the cockfighting magazines have bulk mail permits. Every year, magazines have to run a state of circulation where they list their data. So those are, good, accurate numbers. Anyone else?
Do those
dogfighters,
do they breed their own dogs, or do they buy dogs from other sources?
Both. Some people breed
the dogs, and sometimes it's by a fighting dog. They just learn more about the history of the dog. them purchase the dog. Guys send for dogs all the way from, they come from Atlanta to Chicago, Mississippi to Chicago. They'll basically mail you a dog. I mean, really, literally, they'll mail you.
And they're also chasing off those guys who leave dogs in front of the dog life.
Say it again.
Going after those guys who help clean the dogs.
Well, the people that breed dogs for fighting have to know which ones to breed. They have to know which ones are the best fighters that carry those characteristics they want to pass on to the offspring. So the people breeding fighting animals are doing something. They're either fighting them, giving them someone to go fight for them. They're doing some sort of testing process to figure out which ones to breed. And that's why in Georgia, we worked to get a law enacted that made it illegal to possess a dog with the intent to fight, so that a lot of these folks who we couldn't catch at the fights because they move around so much could still be put out of business.
That's it.
Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.